Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Here I am with a ball and chain, yeah.
Thin Lizzy and Whiskey in the Jar, released as a single on the 3rd of November in 1972 on the Decca label, and it was included on their third studio album, Vagabonds of the Western World, which was released 10 months later in September 1973.
They didn't want this released, you know.
No, I know. You read that as well. Secret. Oh!
I'm a secret lemonade drinker.
You are. I can't believe you got right in there.
Yeah, I'm sorry about
that. On guard, Starlight.
Well, we haven't played Thin Lizzy so far. And it's a band that, I mean, you know, peppered my history, certainly, because of the twin guitar thing. Of course, that sound was completely stolen from Wishbone Ash. That's the whole thing, you know. That. Well, not stolen, but certainly plagiarised. You know, Phil Lynott, what a great guy, you know. He was an excessive in every way. Drugs, women, alcohol, absolutely everything. But he co-wrote most of the stuff, didn't he?
He didn't.
He didn't write this, because this is a traditional song, isn't it?
Yeah, this is one where you can kind of change the names of everybody from, because it changed. It was one of those folk songs that you could, it depended on whether or not you different towns in Ireland, and also sometimes the Appalachians as well in America because of the Irish settlers over there. So it's just an amazingly famous song. It's all about a highwayman that robs somebody and he's betrayed by his wife or his girlfriend or something.
Fantastic. And playing on this, of course, is Eric Bell. Now, Eric Bell, the guitar player, and I had the great pleasure of playing with him. And basically, there you are. And I played this song with him.
No, you did not.
I certainly did. And I'll tell you what, it was in Edenfield, and a friend of ours, a guy called Pete Barton, right?
Yeah.
Actually, put like a night on in Edenfield in this pub.
I'm not kidding.
And I rocked up there. Right? And on bass guitar, you never guess who was on bass guitar.
Go on, tell me.
Mitch Mitchell, who was the drummer in the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh, my God.
Now, it was the most surreal night in the whole world, because I actually watched Eric Bell play this. I was playing rhythm guitar, and Mitch Mitchell was on bass. And I actually can't remember who was on drums, but it was somebody pretty famous, and I can't remember who was. But it's a very, very odd. And he used my amp. This is Eric Bell. Now, Eric Bell, when he played this, he played it in the most unusual way you could ever imagine, because he doesn't go across the neck. Like a traditional guitar player, generally speaking, goes like up and down the neck from like the low strings to the high strings, like across and slightly down. So there's patterns.
Vertically.
That's right. But he actually goes up and down. So all those little riffs, you know, all those, they're all up and down the neck. So he's like, he's moving an awful lot, which doesn't seem logical. It doesn't look right. But he told me, and I asked him afterwards why, and he said, well, a lot of Irish show bands, and he was in an Irish show band, that was his history, that's what they used to do. And it was a tradition that they actually had. So he played in a very, very unusual style. So if you ever want to try and learn that track to play it, don't try and go across. You've got to go up and down like a crazy man or woman.
Well, that's what a story. Is that in the pub? Because I used to live in Edenfield. Was that the pub where the sheep were in the field next to it?
Well,
that one halfway up the road.
It's right at the top at the junction of Ramsbottom. But there you are. It's absolutely incredible. I can't remember what it's called now, but it was incredible. And in fact, we saw Pete Barton, because Pete Barton lent us a keyboard for the last bit of the tour, didn't he?
He did, our recent UK tour, the Starlight Campbell Band, yeah.
Pete Barton.
And I met him for the first time.
Yeah.
Cool
and
guy.
The other thing in this as well, which I didn't know, is that Gary Moore joined the band very, very early on. And then left.
Yes, I know,
again.
I read that.
And I didn't even know about that.
It's a family, and the more and more I get to know about all this, I mean, I'm really terrible with names because I haven't met people face to face, and usually if it's after gig, I'm so hyper that I can't remember anything.
Well, the other thing, and I've just been reading about it, because we do a bit of research. I mean, Starlight does all the research, don't you?
You
look into everything. I just have a quick look on producers normally, just see what's been going on. But the keyboard player who later worked with them was a guy called Darren Wharton. This is and there's a picture of him on Wikipedia. And Darren Wharton plays in a band called Dare. And the drummer of Dare is our mate and played on my first solo record, Kev Whitehead, who now plays in Barclay James Harvest. So there we are. It's an amazing story of, you know, of interconnection and weaving.
It is. And you know what I really love about the stories is that this is a story. The song's a story. And I love the fact that it's been covered by people like Metallica. And then you've got other bands like Peter, Paul and Mary.
You probably find out they were rampant drug takers and alcoholics as well.
Stand and deliver.
Girl with a heart that keeps on changing.
Well, that was Terry Reid and the song Dean from his third studio album, River, released in 1973 on Atlantic Records, produced by the lovely Tom Dowd, one of our favourite producers, and mixed by Eddie Offord, who was Yes's engineer.
Yeah.
Mmm.
Terry Reid, now, he seems to be a bit of a product of his time. I mean, I know people are, but you can feel... You can smell it in the wallpaper in his album, can't you, in his songs. You can smell the time. You know what you're dealing with.
I mean, this was like a sort of jam. It sounds a bit of a jammy, you know. It's like, you know. I think what really pulls it out of the song at a mediocrity a little bit is the guitar work, because David Lindley was playing on that, and it's beautiful guitar. And the groove and the production's fantastic. And I love his voice, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was like one of these unfortunates, wasn't he? He never really achieved his potential, did he?
And the thing is that we're all guilty of this, every single person in the world, really, in terms of the fact that you kind of... can be a little bit lazy, but you don't feel you're lazy. It's just that people come to your attention because they're put in front of you because they have a multi-million pound marketing campaign, or it's word of mouth through friends. And these are, this is what I love about this show, is that it actually takes me off the beaten path. There's a reason for me to do it, so we can talk about it. And with Terry, it's just like, I know there's this whole link to Led Zeppelin, but let me just take you back to the beginning, or near the beginning, with him.
Okay.
So in 1966, his band, the Jaywalkers, were named as a support act for the Rolling Stones for their concert at the Royal Albert Hall. Again, see, the Royal Albert Hall was quite big in this time, wasn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, he met Graham Nash of the Hollies at that gig, and Graham Nash suggested that they sign up with UK Columbia Records, which was an EMI label, and record with a producer called John Burgess. And they did. Their first single, The Soul Inspired, The Hand Don't Fit the Glove, it was a minor hit in 1967, but by then the Jaywalkers had decided to split up. At that point, Reid came to the attention of producer Mickey Most.
Yeah, I'm just reading about him at the moment, Rack Studios. Anyway.
Exactly. So Mickey Most, he became his manager, and also he was in partnership with Peter Green at the time, Led Zeppelin's manager.
Grant.
Sorry, Peter Grant, that's me, and my new glasses. I've got these new varifocals, right? And I'm like reading my notes, and they're a bit fuzzy because I'm not using my varifocals right. It's really weird. Anyway, so Peter Grant. So his first single with Mickey Most was called Better By Far. It became a radio favourite. But the album Bang Bang Your Terry Reid was not a commercial success.
Is that right?
But yeah, Bang Bang Your Terry Reid.
No.
Great title for an album. He also toured the States with Cream. So, you know, what my point being here is that, you know, this guy is not just doing like a small circuit. He's actually up there with all these really, really famous bands with great management, great connections, some opening for people at the Royal Albert Hall, ladies and gentlemen. It's like, this is just not like a small little venue. You're talking the premier venue in London, really.
Yeah.
Anyway, in 1969, Reid fell out with Mickey Most because Most wanted to kind of mould him in this kind of balladeer thing, and that really wasn't his vision for him as an artist, and he's an authentic player. So he decided to go and do a load of live work in the States while they sorted out all the legal work, because he was in legal dispute trying to get out of his contract. And then he signed in 1971 to Atlantic Records, and Ahmet Ertegun signed him up. So you're talking cream of the crop. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing...
And also, he had a great voice. Yeah.
So what happened?
Well, I don't know. You know something? It's the songs, isn't it? And when, you know, I mean, here, he's got Tom Dowd, one of the greatest producers of all time.
Exactly. Aretha Franklin, Tom Dowd.
And the sound of this record is beautiful. It's a beautifully recorded record. You listen to it, you know, and the mix is superb. It really is. You know, very American sounding, but it has that sort of feel of, you know, of that swampy thing going on down in, you know, down in the South. It's got that sort of, do you know what I mean?
But you're right, it's the songs, because really, at the end of the day, no matter how great a guitar player or singer you are, or how great the producers are or the team behind you, if the song doesn't connect, then you've got no connection.
Well, you listen to Little Feat, like we had on last week, and then you listen to this. It's got a similar sort of thing.
Mm.
But, of course, Little Feat, the song was better, you know? And I don't know.
And it was interesting. It's just interesting. It's also, obviously, music is a feel thing, and it's how it makes you feel.
That's right.
But, you know, good on him. I mean, what a great life.
He was asked
you know?
To join Led Zeppelin as well, Terry Reid, wasn't he? So?
No, that was a myth. That's a myth. It was. Well, it wasn't the Led Zeppelin. What it was is that he was asked to go and fill in some dates for the new Yardbirds.
Right. Okay.
So what happened was that he couldn't do it because he'd already got commitment to the tour.
Yeah.
And so then what he did is he was the one that got Bonham and Plant together.
I'm glad you know these things.
Well, no, it's quite cool, eh? But I love that. And it's really funny, right, because there's a quote from Robert Plant. And he said, 2004, Plant got up to sing with Terry Reid. And he told the crowd, said, this man should have had my life, mind you. I'm not sure he'd want it. And Terry Reid said, well, typically tongue cheek, well, I wouldn't mind some of the money. Suede and the Beautiful Ones, the second single from their third studio album, Coming Up, which was released on the 14th of October in 1996 on Nude Records.
Interesting, because this is the first album that they did after Bernard Butler had left.
Yeah.
Now, I love Bernard Butler and as a guitar player, and a lot of people said he was one of the best guitar players for a generation. But the interesting thing about Suede, and it's an unusual one for us to play this, because it's like a sort of a Britpop thing, really. But we're into songs, I think we're into production. And we're also into, of course, our record collection. This is, you know, part of our vinyl collection. And
I
thought we'd stick it on, you know?
It is it's a beautiful song. And I think that depending on the treatment of it and when it's recorded and how it's recorded, you could... The song stands up on its own, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And, you know, I mean, they were massive, Suede. They're one of the biggest and fastest selling acts of all time, I think, in terms of when they first came out in the UK.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Because I remember all of a sudden they were, you know, you hadn't heard of them, and then they were literally everywhere, you know?
It was interesting because when you read about it, but I always thought they were slightly different. And they were a lab band, but there was something about the songs really light. And I know their second album, they kind of distanced themselves from that kind of Britpop thing, because at one point they were like one of the Magic Four, weren't they, in terms of helping create the genre with Oasis, there's Blur, Pulp and Suede. And yet they're very different. What I really liked about this album and why we debated before we included this in the show was that when this is interesting, and we didn't know about this, by the way, until I started researching it.
You're going to tell me, aren't you?
Yeah. Is that they actually started listening to T-Rex as like the actual beginnings of how they were going to record this album.
No.
Yeah, so it was like the blueprint for how they were going to record. And so they listened to Tanks and they listened to some early T-Rex. And what they did is they started off basically like with just basic acoustic instruments and recorded and built up the songs as Mark Bolan would have done.
Because when Tony Visconti, I was reading the book, of course, saw Mark Bolan for the first time and T-Rex, or Tyrannosaurus Rex, as they were then, there was him on acoustic guitar and there was a bongo player. And I do believe they started off with bongos.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. That's weird that you should say that, because I was just, I hadn't got my notes then, but you're right. Bongos, tambourine and acoustic guitar.
Now, you know, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that, because... I think that a lot of music now is really, you know, it's form of a function. It doesn't actually do the job because the songs are not there. And I know, I might sound like I'm, you know, harking back to the 70s and 60s. But this is actually, you know, we're talking a lot later on here, but there were good songs, you know.
I think I was trying to think about this as well. There's music and there's songs. Songs have a message, and the songwriting that we thought very long and deeply about before we embarked again together on this kind of aspect of our career, working together as a band, is all about our duty to society, our to document life and to say something. And it almost reminds me, you know, like Stop the Pigeon with... You know, he's got like a message because he's like the postal pigeon. Well, he had a message. He's got things to say. And I think music that has a message or has things to say is a song. Usually it's a song. And I think a lot of the music at the moment, and I'm not decrying that, but I'm just saying that it's more a fluttering of wings. There's no content. It's just a soundscape. It's not really saying anything, but it's a feelscape. It makes you feel certain things. And there's a very significant difference to it being a song. A story.
I think that what seems to have happened, and, you know, I love architecture, as you know, and I've talked to a lot of, and I've got lots of architecture books, and one of the first things that a guy called Christoph Egret told me, he's a great architect, and he came over to the Isle of Man a couple of years ago. He's a really great guy, good friend.
Yeah, he's a lovely man.
You know, Stirling Prize winner and all that, amazing guy. And he said that architects often forget about the people that are in the buildings. They think about the buildings, they don't think about somebody actually using them. And I think that's sort of what music's got to now, because everybody's talking about production. You've got a million tracks in Pro Tools that you can use. You've got all sorts of effects. You can do basically anything that your imagination desires. But, right, that has, I think, diluted the need for a great song.
I remember you well. In the Chelsea Hotel, you were talking so brave and so sweet, giving me head on the unmade bed, while the limousines wait in the street. Those were the reasons, that was New York. We were running for the money and the flesh. that was called love. For the workers in song, probably still is for those of them left. Yeah, but you got away, didn't you, babe? You just turn your back on the crowd. You got away, I never once heard you say, I need you, I don't need you. I need you, I don't need you. And all of them jiving around. I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. You were famous, your heart was a legend. You told me again you preferred handsome men, but for me you would make an exception. And clenching your fist for the ones like us who are oppressed by the figures of beauty, you fixed yourself. You said, well, never mind, we are ugly but we have the music. And then you got away, didn't you, baby? You just turn your back on the crowd. You got a way I never once heard you say, I need you, I don't need you. I need you, I don't need you. And all of that jiving around. To suggest that I loved you the best, I can't keep track of each fallen robin. I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. That's all, I don't even think of you that often.
Leonard Cohen, Chelsea Hotel number 2 from the fourth studio album, New Skin for the Old Servant, released on the 11th of August 1974 on Columbia Records, produced or co-produced by John Lissauer. Now.
What are you going to say now?
What do you think about that? Because that is a song. And just think about it in the time, right? Giving me head on the unmade bed. Right? That's a lyric. That's a lyric that would be banned easily by the BBC and by everybody. And but he sung it so naturally. And, you know, a fabulous lyric.
I mean, he's a poet. He was a poet before he started singing. I mean, I know he learned guitar sort of early on, but really he was quite a famous poet before he sort of... And it's a natural extension from poetry into music, really, because he's a lyricist, isn't he?
Well, it's magnificent. And what I love about that production, and you know, we're just carrying on from the conversation we're having about Suede, that, you know, this is function over form, you know, because this, there's no reverb on it at all. There's a little bit of orchestral stuff in the background, tiny bit. It's so dry, but the quality of his voice, of the quality of the song, the quality of the production, just, it shines through. It, like, illuminates the room with beauty.
It's timeless. And, yeah. And in a way, I know they said it has, like, a more European feel, but for me, I mean, maybe I'm biased. He's somebody that you actually have to really think about, because Leonard Cohen, because he's... feels very grey to me and a little bit dangerous, Leonard Cohen.
I think he always was dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, the one song I knew about him when I was growing up was called Suzanne. I was thinking, yeah, I've got a song named after me. And there's like, Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. I was thinking, oh, for goodness sake, man. And everybody, you know when somebody or lots of people say he's amazing and you haven't really got to a place where you can feel the same? It's a little bit of a scary place. You either close them out, which I have done, because I'm thinking, oh, at some point we'll meet in a room and it'll be fine. I'm not sort of anti-Leonard Cohen. I'm quite happy to meet him musically, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just, It's got to be both of us in the room at the same time. I can't just... Do you understand that? In terms
well, I do.
Of...
And, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, the melody can sort of be pulled out. I mean, you look at other great songwriters, Bob Dylan, for example. I mean, Bob Dylan, the covers of his songs have actually been more successful. And he's the sort of... Mm. They haven't extemporized on the melody because the melody's already there. All they've done is sung it really well. And, you know, and it's a similar sort of thing with Leonard Cohen, I think.
What intrigued me about him is that he actually deliberately moved into the Chelsea Hotel so he could be around people, similar people. He wanted to meet and be inspired by other people, so he went to the scene.
Mm.
You've been to the Chelsea Hotel?
Yeah, I have indeed. I've been a couple of times. Very, very interesting. Very interesting place. I remember going up in the lift and there was a... it was quite a long time ago, and I hadn't seen a right lot of transvestites then, but there was a transvestite in the lift, and I didn't know what to do because I just didn't, you know, you just didn't see them in Bury, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was cool, and, you know, she was really, really amazing, actually. You know, really glammed up, and I thought, wow, you know.
Wow.
And that was the first taste of the Chelsea Hotel, you know, for me. Anyway, that's another thing.
But, you know, when I was thinking about how would you describe Leonard Cohen? I went and looked at some reports just in summary, and they said that he's one of the most fascinating and enigmatic, if not the most successful, singer-songwriters of the late 60s. He retained an audience across six decades of music making, interrupted by various digressions into personal and creative exploration, all of which only added to the mystique surrounding him, a little bit like Tom Waitsy type. Character, would you think, or not? Mm. Similar.
Yeah, that's right. A bit of an enigma, really. But his, you know, his music lives on, and, you know, there's so many songs, you know, because we played Jennifer Warnes of the Week, oh. An interpretation of Famous Blue Raincoat, which is magnificent, you know. Yeah. Again, another great song that was sung brilliantly by somebody else.
The Who? Sorry, I had to say it that way. Substitute, the single version, which was released in March 1966. Great year. On the Reaction label in the UK and the ATCO label in the US of A.
Sounds like a soap pod, doesn't it? That's ACDO, isn't it?
No, and that Acme is the dynamite company, isn't it? Or something, and all the gadgets.
Yeah, it went to number 5 in the UK charts and later included on the compilation album Meaty Beaty Big and Bouncy, 1971.
Say that again.
Meaty Beaty Big and Bouncy.
And yeah, they're having a laugh.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That is so funny.
Well, you know, this band, this was produced by Pete Townsend at my favourite studio, of course, Olympic
Studios.
Again, you know, when I listened to this between American recordings and British recordings, so there's no doubt that the American recordings done, you know, around that same time were actually, they sounded sort of better, really. They were like better quality and everything. But there's something, the attitude about the British sound. It's just a bit rough, a bit dirty. It's a bit slightly distorted. It sounds like everybody's going mad in the studio, you know, they're going crazy.
And can I just say as well, I have seen other people try and do that that don't have it. And it just looks silly.
Yeah.
It's just not something that you can make happen. You've either got it or you haven't.
That's right.
And I mean that quite sincerely. And I don't mean to be horrible to anybody else. But you've got it or it's not. That's it.
Well, the Who certainly had it. The Horrible Who.
Well, do you know what I was realising as well? Sorry to cut across you then. But this track, which I didn't realise until I looked into it, was primarily inspired by the Tracks of My Tears by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles.
No.
Yeah, because Pete Townsend apparently became obsessed, particularly with the line, although she may be cute, she's just a substitute. This led him to write the song around that word.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
Well, the lyric, again, it's a great lyric, this, you know, it's very much of its time. There was a lot of anger in The Who, that, you know, my generation.
Yeah.
You know.
You can tell by the way he got his guitar developed with old Fender.
Yeah. And he was going...
He's gone mad.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that whole thing with, you know, his SG and his boiler suit and live, they were, you know, that performance at Woodstock was fantastic, you know, amazing performance.
Absolutely. But, you know, if you've it's almost a bit scary, but if you, and I can imagine really the guys with lots of testosterone, you're just having that because it's a chemical thing as well. Like if you have that, it's in you, it's part of your reaction, you know, it's part of who you are as a person.
But the lead guitarist, i.e. John Entwistle on bass, kind of odd thing to say. Yeah, and Keith Moon together, though, were a mighty force, you know. No hi-hat. He was just bashing the hell out of those cymbals all the time and smacking the drums. But it worked, you know. It just worked as a band. Very, very unusual sound, but it just worked.
Do you know what's interesting as well? You know, for the American single release, and I was just thinking about tonight, actually, just in terms of, you know, how I interact with people in different parts of the world, especially on Facebook or other social media sites. There are sometimes people will say something and you think, you probably wouldn't normally say that if you knew that that was slightly a little bit weird, you know, for our culture and vice versa, I'm sure. So for the American single version of Substitute, which was released in April 1966, the line in the chorus, I look all white but my dad was black, was changed.
No.
Yep. To, I try walking forward but my feet walk back.
Thank you. Radiohead, Nude, released in March 2008 as the second single from their seventh studio album, In Rainbows, and released in the year before on Excel label in the UK, part of Beggar's Banquet Group, and TBD label in the USA.
And that, my best friend in the whole universe, is probably one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard in my life. I absolutely love that song.
We saw him do it on Jonathan Ross, didn't we? Live. And I'm not kidding. It was breathtakingly good.
It's so... it's beautiful.
It is incredible. And his vocal and the space. Nigel Godrich produced that. And the In Rainbows album was a very troublesome album for him because they spent a lot of time without Nigel Godrich, just recording and trying to get it together. But after a prolonged amount of time, he kicked him up the arse, according to Tom York.
Yeah.
And did the album, which in actual fact is probably my favourite album of all time, In Rainbows.
I know you love Radiohead, and it's really odd, you know.
And you bought me the vinyl to this.
No.
And it's just an incredible production. It's an incredible song. The closeness, I don't know Godrich does it, I don't know he gets that sound. It's so close and so intimate. The drums as well, the snare drum is just beautiful.
But it feels like, you know, you're right about the space, but it's intimate with the space of the universe. It's like intimate and infinite at the same time. It just feels that it's micro and macro, you know, just completely I'm a little bit teary. I just feel very it's an odd really, because I've heard that song before, and it's just that, you know, when you actually just have the liberty to sit down, and I know that we're listening to the songs and we're talking
on cams
about
as
stuff,
well, it's sort of,
it's sounds, very, yeah, very, very personal. And I know that it took a few goes, didn't it? Because they recorded this, and then they weren't happy with it on their third album. It was going to be on their third album, and they actually just, it took them about 10 years and playing it live at different guises too. And then they rewrote the bass line, and it all just happened. But it's about a window of time, Nigel was saying that. And sometimes with Nude, they missed that window of time, and it wasn't just the song that had to be written. It's just the fact that the people had changed who were singing it, and they had to kind of reconnect to it to get the feel.
Well, the bass in that, I mean, it's just a lovely, well, the whole arrangement, I can't actually pick anything out that's not great in it, you know. The sound of it, It's just magnificent. And but they recorded it in a place called Tottenham House in Marlborough, Wiltshire. This is in Rainbows.
Yeah.
And it's country house scouted by Godrich. But it was actually completely dilapidated. There was holes in the roof, there was rain coming in, and there was some place in the house that didn't go. And according to Tom York, they had a very funny atmosphere about the whole place. But it kind of comes across.
Yeah.
Because the album is so, you know, it's schizophrenic, really, because there's some track like that, and all of a sudden you get Body Snatchers. It looks amazing. But, you know, if there's one band that I've seen live more than anybody else, it's Radiohead. I've seen them on numerous occasions. They're fantastic live, brilliant musicians.
I need to see them, you know. I want to stand in the room. I mean, even though I adore their recordings, I'd love to see them live. We've got to go and see them.
Well, you know.
Hear them live.
They were absolutely amazing every time I've seen them, because the precision, but also the, you know, what they do on stage, they really get into it. You know, they're really into it and very much a band, you know, when they're going.
And I did read, and I was trying to work out, you know, Radiohead, who are they? And they kind of represent that kind of fearless experimentation, don't they? They are a bunch of friends that hung out at school together that have just pushed boundaries, have really just gone places when it wasn't cool to go and do what they did. And they completely, they've taken control of their albums. They're independently produced now. But they also just go, let's go over that hill and just see what's over there.
I think they're one of the most original bands, commercially successful original bands, that's out there, because each time they release something, it blows you away. I mean, I remember when they did Kid A, you know, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't listen to it at the beginning because it was just so odd.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, and then you listen to it back now, and it's such a great record. We got a double 10-inch final, haven't we, that?
I know. And what's interesting, then, they talk about them sort of inheriting the mantle from David Bowie and Pink Floyd and Talking Heads, but they weren't like the Heads. And they didn't really take much from Bowie, because it's, except for maybe his willingness to experiment, but they kind of did a splice of like Floyd's spaciness with U2's messianic kind of arena rock and just kind of did stuff.
Well, you know, Johnny Greenwood's one of my favourite modern guitar players, you know. Great sounds, great tones, great, just great, 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 great. That's all I can say about Radiohead. Great, great, great.
And what's not so great? It's the end of the show, darling.
No. Oh, no, that's really taken us aback, that Radiohead track, hasn't it?
I know, amazing. I'm a little bit teary. Anyway, I hope you've really enjoyed the show with us this week. You can get in contact with us on Twitter, Susie and Simon, on Facebook.
And iHeartRadio we're on iTunes, we're on Spotify, we're everywhere, aren't we?
We are indeed. And thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to play you out with a song by a really kooky band called Can. And a song called, I know, it's funny, isn't it, called Moonshake. They're a German experimental rock group. I love them, right? And that they were always at least three steps ahead of contemporary popular music. They were the leading avant-garde rock group of the 70s.
Yeah.
They do make me smile. And from the very beginning, their music didn't conform to any commonly held notions about rock and roll, not even of the countercultures. And they were inspired more by 20th century classical music than Chuck Berry, they say.
Can, Noy, and, you know,
they're
Kurt Rock.
They're a family,
brilliant,
aren't they?
Yeah, brilliant stuff.
They're a kick-ass band. So what I really like, though, is that they kind of like, you know, you can feel there's like a kind of Frank Zappa-esque or maybe a bit of a Velvet Underground vibe going with them. But, you know, I mean, it was pretty serious stuff and inaccessible.
And this is the last album to feature Damo Suzuki, who I saw in Liverpool, actually.
I
certainly did, yeah. So there you are.
What? I tell you what then, see you next week, and we'll leave you with a Moonshake
with Damo Suzuki
and Can.